Welcome, listeners, to our second series of the Student Accommodation Podcast, brought to you by City Room Rentals, a leading student housing platform and agency partner. I'm Nick Findlay, and each week we're going to continue bringing you a brand new episode with a range of fantastic guests that live and breathe all things student housing. I'm delighted to announce our fresh new sponsor for this series is Y-First, the European Wi-Fi leader with over 17 years of experience and over 1,900 residences deployed across Europe. Today on the show, we'll be focusing on the same format in terms of a broad set of topics on the student housing market, with the aim of getting a diverse, well-rounded viewpoint from our expert guests on the outlook for the sector. I'm delighted to welcome on the podcast today a leading player within the student housing sector, this well-known figure. He's been around the student housing industry for many years, starting off his career with Liberty Living, then moving on to the student housing company, where he spearheaded growth as chief operating officer alongside CEO Bob Crompton, driving the business into a leading developer operator before its successful exit to GSA. Most recently, he's taken up the role of global CEO of Nido Student to drive expansion for the group across the UK, Ireland and continental Europe, backed by Roundhill Capital. So, without further ado, we're delighted to welcome on the show Mr. Brian Welsh. Welcome on the show, Brian. Thank you for coming on to share your expertise with us today.
Thanks, Nick. Great to be here.
Good. Well, kick off then, Brian. How are things, a broad question, how are things going over at the Nido Collection for 2019 so far?
Pretty positively, Nick. We're in the ground developing residences in a bunch of different countries, in Ireland, Portugal and in the Netherlands. So it's great to be able to do a lot of travel and bring our product to a wider audience.
Good. And in terms of sort of the last few months, you've obviously announced a number of exciting developments, sort of schemes in Cork, Lisbon, and as you said, the Netherlands, to name a few. So what's the plans for those schemes, Brian? Are they coming on sort of the next couple of years? Are they quite far ahead? Or?
Well, that's right. We're doing, they're all in the ground at the moment. So we've got quite a lot of residences opening up in 2020, a few residences opening in 21, and actually a couple opening up in 2019 as well, although those ones are in the UK. So lots of action going on. As I say, we think the market's really strong, and we've been working hard to find opportunities that fit within our investors' return parameters.
Okay. And for you then, Brian, how do you feel the student housing market is performing in 2019? Perhaps so far in the UK, we're obviously going into that sort of peak student letting cycle, but you know, is it looking, would you say, pretty healthy across the broad spectrum?
In general, yes. I think there are some markets out there in the UK that are pretty tough, where letting cycles are happening later than they have done in previous years, and where potentially there's been a lot of additional stock entering the marketplace. But overall, it's a healthy picture within the sector. And I think any short-term indigestion is likely to work its way through the system over the next, this cycle and the next one. So feeling pretty good over at Nido Student.
Any particular markets there, Brian, you'd perhaps say were causing concern, even if you're not in those particular cities? Any sort of rumblings you would say, you know, or you're proving slightly more difficult than others?
Well, somewhere like Sheffield has seen an incredible amount of development over the past couple of years. And there's another, I think, in excess of 2,000 beds coming out of the ground in Sheffield at the moment.
Wow.
So we're seeing that being a particular city where we don't currently have a presence. However, I think what's fair to say is that the best located product at reasonable rents and with great service levels that really hit the sweet spot will be okay and will continue to be okay. I think it's some more peripheral ones that are maybe a couple of miles out of town and move a student from being able to walk to university to having to get public transport or having to think longer and harder about how they're going to make it, especially in the winter months where it might be colder. I think it's those outliers that are maybe having a few more difficulties. And my experience, it's a big question of value money and the service you're offering the students. And I think if you get that right, then students will come and will choose your rooms. If you are more of a, let's call it a traditional low service landlord, maybe in a secondary location, then you're going to have a tougher time out there.
Yeah. And would you say, as we're seeing, depending on the city, obviously development opportunities become harder to come by and schemes are becoming further and further, say, out of the city centre. Do you see those particular schemes sometimes as being sort of, you know, quite risky per se, given if there's extra travel time for the students or if the price point's correct? Or is it just a sort of a cost benefit analysis?
Well, that's right. I think there's a few things happening out there. And I think one of the real headwinds that the future developments have in UK student in particular at the moment is the increasing build cost inflation that we're seeing across the UK and indeed in many places in continental Europe as well. So if what it costs you to build the thing is accelerating more quickly than the rents are accelerating, then the margins get squeezed right the way up the value chain. And you get to the point where it's more and more difficult to deliver new product in line with business plans. That alongside competing use classes, which can sometimes outbid or frequently outbid student developers for sites, especially in the A1 locations, mean there's increasing pressure on the sector's ability to deliver stock into the marketplace. And this is a very much a micro location game as well. So if you're in the position where, I don't know if you're in Manchester, where you have a planning regime, which is quite, or in the past has made it quite tough for student developers to get planning permission of adequate scale to make the developments viable, then, you know, there's just one more headwind which slows your development down. The community infrastructure levy in SIL has been stacked against student development in some cities. And we're starting to see in London with the latest version of the London plan, featuring a lot of a focus on affordable student housing, which is great and perfectly laudable. And I think everybody would support trying to deliver affordable student housing. But the commercial reality is when land prices are high and potentially getting higher, alternative use classes such as everything from service departments to hotels to residential is squeezing you out. Now the latest requirement to have, in order to manage through the affordable housing and the SIL contributions, needing to be in some sort of joint venture structure, ideally with a higher education institution. All things combined to make it very difficult to develop in London in particular in that sense. So we're seeing very, very specific problems in very, very specific locations. There are some places which are still great to develop in, but are hard to get planning. And the places where it might be easier to get planning might not necessarily have the rental tone, which would allow an investor to generate a return from their capital. So a bunch of things are happening to mean that the future pipeline might begin to slow down in the medium term. But we are seeing short term, a fair amount of development in the UK at the moment.
And with that, Brian, how serious an issue, you know, we've talked quite a lot about the build cost inflation, but do you see that being a continual issue perhaps for the next couple of years? Because I've heard as much as sort of 20% sometimes year on year in terms of build cost inflation. What sort of are your experience, would you say, in terms of how that's putting pressure on developers?
Well, one might contend that we're in a perfect storm situation on build cost inflation here. So there's been a well-established trend of taking the manpower side of it, first of all, or the personnel power. There's been a long-term decline in the number of school leavers in the UK wanting to move into the building trade because, you know, it compared with maybe sitting in an office, in a nice air-conditioned office, tapping into a computer, walking around a building site in February, carrying a hod load of bricks, it has become less appealing. I'm not painting the greatest picture of it. It's probably nice in July, but, you know, there are fewer and fewer British school leavers moving into these trades. So if you walk around building sites, particularly in the southeast, you'll see there's been a very high reliance on immigrant labour. And this might have been publicised in some areas of the media as being the people coming in from Poland, aware of Romania or CEE, willing to work for lower wages. I don't think that is the big problem here. I think the problem is that they are filling gaps that are left vacant by British school leavers who actually don't want to do those jobs. So I think if you triple the wages, you might see more people going into it, but I don't think it would deal with the structural deficit in number of tradespeople available within the domestic UK market. So as we get into the sort of Brexit theme and people from Eastern Europe are feeling potentially less welcome because of some of the rhetoric that's been coming out of Westminster, we're starting to see the number of people available to perform these jobs reducing, and therefore, you know, they are starting to command higher wages.
Right.
So that's one side of it. It's the ability of availability of labour in a lot of these UK markets. The other side of that, of course, is the materials that you require to develop a purpose-built student accommodation block of scale, some of which, or a good bunch of which, is likely to come from a different country. And in order to buy that, you need to be dealing with currency markets. And as we know, the British pound has dropped something like 20% over the last couple of years since the original Brexit referendum result. And so that in and of itself will put pressure on margins and means that you're buying stuff in which is 20% more expensive. And then also there's of course the risk premium. So we are recording this in June. The next supposed drop dead date for the Brexit negotiations is the 31st of October. So there is clearly a risk premium in that, where if we're forward funding developments in the UK as we are, then that developer has a responsibility to deliver that residence through the Brexit process. So if worst case scenario, some workers from mainland Europe or from Ireland were no longer allowed to work in the UK on the 1st of November, then that main contractor will be obliged to fill those gaps somehow on the 1st of November. So whilst, I don't think anybody believes that's likely to be the case. It's incredibly unlikely to happen, the Armageddon scenario there. Yeah. But it is still a risk. It is still a consideration. And when people are tendering for work, they may well price that into their bid. So there are two or three key drivers, I think, behind build cost inflation. Now, some of that might be bought back if the pound starts to bounce back, or people may have hedged more, have more effective hedging strategy in the future, or there may be more domestic availability of supplies. However, those things take time to mobilize and to build up.
Yep.
And they all require financing, they all require funding, they all require availability of decent bank debt. And those are also three things that are kind of still, things are still happening in and around Brexit, but it's only at a slower rate. Business doesn't like uncertainty, and uncertainty is one thing we have plenty of in the UK at the moment.
Yeah, it's a complex issue there, Brian. I mean, you've touched on those three points, but yeah, it does sound quite a lot of variables there, contributing to those challenges. So, Brian, I wanted to circle back, if I may, to you're talking about your opportunities in Ireland. And obviously yourself and the Student Housing Company days were sort of early pioneers really in developing over in Ireland. How do you feel about the Irish market overall, Brian? Do you still feel there's tremendous opportunity if we perhaps look at Dublin first? Or do you think that sort of first mover advantage is perhaps now gone?
Well, I mean, the first thing you look at when you're interested in investing in student accommodation in any city or any country is, are there lots of students and how many beds are there? And in Dublin, that sort of student-to-bed ratio feels really healthy.
Okay.
So contrast it with some UK cities, Dublin still feels really good. I think people who've attended conferences where I've spoken have heard me labouring the same points many times. And the fact remains that we're trying to solve problems for people who are seeking housing. And the most acute problems are in cities, and the most acute problems within cities tend to be in capital cities across Europe, which is our primary area of focus. So there's a big trend of urbanization, of people moving towards cities in general. And that, those people moving towards cities are putting increased pressure on housing stock. And that's a very acute problem right now in Dublin. So in general, there is a requirement for more residential accommodation in Dublin. Student accommodation is part of that solution. And we think those trends are widening. So more and more students are coming to Dublin, and they will continue to be a net beneficiary of the Brexit process, as they would, in a post-Brexit era, be the only English-speaking European country. Sorry, country within the EU. Sorry, very Freudian slip there. So they will continue to benefit from international students trending towards Dublin. We see a lot of Americans, a lot of Chinese students, increasing numbers of Chinese students going into that market, all of whom require accommodation, all of whom are putting additional pressure on the local housing stock. So this urbanization thing is a particularly acute problem in Dublin. Now, there are increased levels of development of purpose-built student accommodation in Dublin, or have been since we started looking at that market back in 2011. However, I don't think the level of accommodation has tipped beyond a sustainable level in the medium term in the Dublin market. So where you do have a problem in any market is if you run in and start delivering 100% of the residences at a super high price point. But I don't think we've seen that in Dublin. I think we're seeing an increasing number of en-suite rooms as opposed to studios. And I think in general, we're seeing a rental tone which we feel is sustainable in Dublin.
And with that sort of touching on the rents there, Brian, there's been quite a lot of student protests in particular in Dublin. I think that the main one has been Take Back Our City, which has been quite widespread with protests. I think the Irish government's now introducing a sort of rent cap across the board, which is going to include student accommodation. Do you see that being any sort of particular risk for development or for the future sort of development for, underwriting these schemes?
Well, certainly it's another element that people need to consider when choosing to invest in a country or not, or in a city or not. And investors have tended to shy away, or some investors have tended to shy away from countries which do have a level of rent control. We are developing in the Netherlands at the moment within a rent-controlled environment. We're working very closely on projects in the German market, which also has a level of control around what rents are charged in the markets. So that's just another factor, another element that you need to factor into your initial appraisal and underwrite as to whether you can deliver a product given the how much it costs to build, how much you're paying for the land, the quality of service you can provide, how much it costs you to run, and how much the rent looks like. And you can kind of extrapolate that over a number of years and work up a cash flow forecast from that based on those criteria. In the event that that appraisal doesn't look attractive to an investor, then things won't get built. I think the danger of rent control is it can be quite a blunt instrument, and it can certainly affect the volume of development, which will only seek to increase pressure on housing stock. So you see, in the UK, traditionally, we've shied away from governmental policy in favour of rent controls because the net effect of that is likely to be a reduction in the availability of stock. So it's a kind of a fetter on the free market economy. But what it's worth, the Dublin rental control element might be falling in around 4%, which is probably acceptable to most investors in a benign inflationary environment. I think you start to get difficulty if inflation runs in excess of 4%, and then suddenly it becomes more expensive to operate and your margins get squeezed on an ongoing basis. The business plans for these residences don't throw off as much super high returns to allow for a major difference in if that NOI EBITDA gets squeezed too far, then it does become a problem for an investor.
Okay, and what about for the rest of Ireland then, Brian? If we perhaps look at sort of markets like Galway or Cork, Limerick, are they on your radar perhaps for future development?
Absolutely right. They absolutely are. We're developing in Cork at the moment, so we're just in the process of closing down our first asset in Galway as well. And we talk with a lot of other investors, and we do both investment work and we do third-party property management work. And so we're in communication with a bunch of investors who are developing in those cities as well. These are smaller cities, significantly smaller than Dublin, but they do still have a structural undersupply of accommodation. So we see that there are opportunities in those cities. Availability of land in somewhere like Galway is relatively low. So finding the right location to put your product of a reasonable scale is difficult. There aren't that many great and available sites in Galway. And Cork is similar. You know, you want to be near a university or near downtown Cork, and those sites there aren't that many of those sites available.
Okay, brilliant. Brian, if I was to ask you, put you on the spot, what would you say you're most excited about, you know, looking ahead for the sector? If you could maybe give me a couple of things that are, you know, perhaps getting you most excited about at the moment.
Well, I think there are just a bunch of things coming around the sector. So I think as a sector in general, the sector is maturing. People are getting better at what they're doing, more efficient, and they're able to deliver additional services and become more of an increasing force for good. And again, people who've heard me talking on the conference circuit will have heard me talking about the Nido pillars, the brand pillars that we have for Nido, which we've developed in association with our students. And we talk so much about sustainability. We talk so much about well-being. We talk about so much about building communities, and we talk about using technology to the best way we can. So we're only just in the foothills of exploring how far we can go with these elements. But if I look at our sustainability agenda here, we've issued all of our students with coffee cups for life, with water bottles for life, with bags for life, and actually with metal straws as well, which you can use over and over. And what we're seeing from very simple distribution of those items, if we make very conservative estimates as to how frequently students use them, and I say how frequently because I use my own versions of those things every day, but if we're saying half the students use them twice a week, then really quickly we're saving 1 million items from going to landfill. But not only that, we're helping our students who are young people who are still kind of finding their way through life. We're helping them say, okay, listen, this is really important. It's really important we don't throw loads of plastic waste into the environment. It's really important that we don't lose polar bears and turtles and all of these incredible things that we've learned from Attenborough programs and everything else. So I'm super excited about being a part of the solution to that and not part of the problem.
Yeah, and with that, Brian, then, have you got any plans perhaps in the near future for more environmentally sustainable accommodation? If students are, you know, obviously buying into and want to be more eco-friendly, if you like. So are there any sort of plans on the horizon in regards to that?
I was really excited to be invited to participate in a roundtable session a few weeks ago on sustainability and purpose-built student accommodation. And that was really good. And we had in there, we had mechanical and electrical engineers, we had architects, we had technology providers, we had procurers of energy services and consultants into the industry, as well as myself and a few other chief executives of businesses who operate in the purpose-built student accommodation space. So what was really apparent in that is some of the great work that's going on already. And we're approaching this in very much a collaborative way across the sector. There's no great, we're not interested in keeping great secrets and me being super sustainable, but the guy down the road, not. It's in everybody's interest to do this. So a lot of us gave up our time to contribute to that conversation, to work on a white paper within the sector to say, okay, this is how you're going to be super sustainable. Now, what's really important to note, and one thing that was resonated in the point I made in the sector, is that actually we are already very, very sustainable in comparison with, particularly on the development side, in comparison with, for example, standard, in inverted commas, HMO style housing stock in the streets. So, you know, we are putting in place these super insulated buildings, for example. So the requirement for additional heating is pretty low. Modern building regs drives us down particular routes, whether that be putting in combined heat and power engines or other sustainability measures such as photovoltaic cells on roofs, or even in some instances, rainwater harvesting systems and all of these other good things that are coming more and more into the sector. But fundamentally, we're bringing people into city centres and taking out disused brownfield sites, which might have had an old factory on them. And we're preventing all of those people from putting pressure on, in many instances, the local transport infrastructure. In general, students don't bring cars into the cities. We're building these projects in Utrecht and Groningen in the Netherlands, which have, you know, one bike space per room. And there's a contention that's maybe not enough for students in the Netherlands, who many of whom will have more than one bicycle each. So we think in principle, and also with the modern buildings that we put in place, our ability to procure energy at more efficient rates. And for example, the lighting systems are all LED lighting in the new blocks. So in general, the sustainable nature of the subset of the property industry we're in is incredible. So we see a lot of the additional work we can do as being working with our students to, for example, our students in Newcastle a few weeks ago were involved in a litter pick with the team, where they went down by the river and they were collecting a litter from the immediate area, which we think is great. We're doing loads of work in the local community and involving our students in local community groupings and helping people out in that way as well. So we're seeing, as a sector, we're doing some great stuff. We think and want to do more because of the people we are, not just trying to greenwash stuff on behalf of our students. We genuinely want to make a difference. And here at Nida Student, I see that every day, but I'm really heartened to say that I see that also in other businesses around the sector.
Good. Okay, no, that's really positive, Brian. Okay, we're just going to take a short ad break now to thank our sponsors, and we'll be back with Brian very shortly. Why First is the series sponsor of the Student Accommodation Podcast, who are a historical provider of Wi-Fi managed services for student accommodations. Regardless of whether you're in the hospitality, senior or student housing industry, you know that a great Wi-Fi connection is a fundamental need for your customers. WiFirst is a leader in managed Wi-Fi services for PBSA, with 17 years of experience and over 1,900 residences deployed across Europe. Trust the European Wi-Fi leader for your next turnkey solution, contacting them on wifirst.com/EN. Okay, we're back, Brian. I'd just like to try and switch focus a little bit and just try and get your perspective. You're with Nido, obviously dealing across multiple different markets, so it's not just the UK that you're focusing on. Are you seeing some sort of key trends, obviously driving the sort of design of private student accommodation at the moment, and are they differing across the markets that you're entering?
Yes to both. I think when you've been in one sector as long as I have, you see a lot of change. And particularly given that our customer is 18 to 25 years old in the main, we do see them, they challenge us a lot of the time to make sure we're constantly innovating and changing our approach. Now, what's difficult in the built environment is you build a student accommodation block and it's expected to be there for 20, 30, 40, 50 years. So trying to design that in mind for, well, if I look at my little girl, that's nearly 8 years old now. So in a decade's time, she could ostensibly be living in a residence that I'm developing today. And looking at her at eight and thinking about what she will be like, thinking about how different her world is to the world that I had when I was 8 years old, that suggests that she's going to be a very different 18-year-old to the 18-year-old we have today, and certainly the 18-year-olds that I was. So we spend a lot of time listening to our customers and saying, okay, well, what do you want? What do you need today? And then looking at the future and saying, okay, what will the customer of tomorrow require? So we are trying to build flexibility into our residences as much as we can, but it's a difficult balance to strike. 5 years ago, or 8 years ago now, sorry, we were taking out common rooms because they were completely unused and study spaces were irrelevant and just dead space in purpose-built student accommodation blocks. Now we're focusing in on those things incredibly deeply, and we're seeing those areas be really desirable for students and used a lot more. So the amenity spaces in student accommodation are improving all of the time in the new developments. And a lot of the old, increasing numbers of the old developments are having common rooms, common room areas, study areas, cinema rooms, music rooms, yoga studios being added in or reinstated where they've been taken out in the past. So for sure, we're seeing big change in those common spaces within the residences. Where we're not seeing that much innovation or change is within the bedrooms. And I think having been around for as long as I have, we've seen almost everything attempted with a 13.5 square meter ensuite room that can be attempted with a 13.5 square meter ensuite room. By the time you think about it, you need to have somewhere to put your clothes, you need a desk, you need a bed, you need an ensuite pod bathroom. Those areas haven't really changed that much. The other limb of your question was around what differences we're seeing in international markets. And therein, the differences are quite significant. It's not right to stereotype or say one size fits all, and there are variables within this. But as a rule of thumb, we would tend to say that Northern European countries, so, well, Germany, Netherlands, let's use those as an example. Perhaps the service offering that's expected from the landlord is lower than the service offering in Southern Europe, by which I mean, if you go to Spain, for example, it might be the norm to deliver towels, sheets, bedding into a room. In Spain, where we've operated there in the past, we've seen a large preponderance for full board accommodation, so catered accommodation, which is very unusual, and it's not something you would see a great deal of in the UK or in the Netherlands or Germany. And also in Spain, for example, you might see a lot more in the way of clubs and societies surrounding your residence, which we are starting to see more of in the UK. But in Spain, it's far more prevalent that you would be expected to socialize in and around your residence, because they don't really do so much in the way of clubs and societies connected to the university. So we are seeing big differences around some of these countries. In Spain, we have historically seen a lot of twin rooms, which have kind of died out in large part in the UK, but still is a large cross-section of the Spanish market, and some of the new developments coming out are still featuring those twin rooms. So it is a macro game that you're playing into, but very much those micro markets require serious attention. And I think what's very dangerous, and I've warned people about before, is just turning up from the UK and thinking that you know best because this market is described as the most mature in terms of volume. That's not the case. As we go into these new markets, we spend a whole load of time on our research phase, both on a quantitative and a qualitative basis. And we talk to people operating in the market and we learn from them as much as we expect to bring our own UK knowledge into different countries. Because these guys who go to Spain, you know, they've been operating purpose-built accommodation in some instances for 10, 15, 20 years in a particular way. It doesn't mean that that's the absolute right way or the only way you can do it in that market, but it's certainly something you need to understand before stepping into that market and bringing perhaps a product which the market doesn't absorb as quickly as they might something different.
So in effect, Brian, you know, we've heard these rumblings before, but in effect is, you know, we can't take our, you know, our success from the UK and try and in part enforce that same model, you know, in Spain or Portugal. We've really got to take the advice on the ground, tailor those products really to each of those markets, to the requirements, and be successful, hopefully, as opposed to just forcing one size fits all.
I think that's right. I think you've got to be extremely sensitive to the market that you're working towards. I think that's how I'd describe it. It's not to say that building an ensuite cluster flat product in Spain won't be successful. In fact, I think it probably will be successful. It's just, I think my point is more that if you are seeing something that is catered, that it's not necessarily going to be unsuccessful. I think there is space for both of those models in that Spanish marketplace. And I think going back to the trends and what, you know, one of the things we're increasingly seeing in the sector in each of these countries is the preponderance of international students to travel and study in these countries, who will bring with them their own expectations of their accommodation. And that's driven in large part by universities becoming more sophisticated and more open to recruiting more and more international students. And we're seeing that in every country. We're working extensively in Portugal at the moment, and some universities we're talking to us are telling us that if three students on any course request the course to be taught entirely in English, then they will accommodate that. So you're seeing some international universities taking massive steps forwards in their international agenda and their willingness and willingness to invest in acquiring international students who will bring with them their own expectations and accommodation. So I think a big trend that we have seen over the years and we're going to see more and more is international students traveling across borders to study.
Okay. Brian, what's, you know, sort of trying to tie that in, you know, on the spaces element you've referred to in the social spaces, what's your take, you know, on the sort of co-living phrase that keeps popping up everywhere? What's your take on it? Do you see opportunities there for your brand to sort of merge the opportunities between PBSA and co-living, or what would be your thoughts?
Well, we spent a lot of time looking at co-living as a firm, and one of our sister businesses, Vivali, is exclusively a co-living brand. So we think we understand that market very, very well. I think in the Venn diagram of co-living and student accommodation in terms of service provision, I see a lot of crossover and a lot of similarities. I see, for example, the back of house business that we have set up between marketing and rentals and health and safety and facilities management and development control processes and specification design, all of those good things. We see all of those skills being directly transferable into co-living. So I think it's potentially a huge part of the property market looking forwards. And I do see the day where we will have student and co-living on the same site. And we do, in fact, you know, in some countries, you have students and co-living in the same building. It's not as much of a differentiation between it in, for example, Germany and micro apartments and student accommodation versus the UK, where there is more of a delineation between the two. But I think we're seeing trends in society move in favor of something like that, where 10, 15, 20 years ago, people would be reticent to have a purpose-built student accommodation block nearby because they would have in their head students being noisy, having loud parties, being not being the world's best neighbors. But I think that opinion, that trend has changed for a number of reasons. One of them being that more and more members of society have actually spent time and been to university. But maybe more than that is the kind of big trend of students moving away from a heavy party, heavy drinking culture to, certainly we're seeing more international students, more studying, more going to the gym, more fitness, more eating well, more general, you know, the increased expenditure and well-being, more people using gyms in residences like ours, or people by, you know, joining health clubs in the street. We're seeing definite direction to more less antisocial behavior across the student accommodation place, which I think opens up those sites to be more mixed use, where somebody who was a student when they were 21 might be now 28, wants to live in London. And hey, there's a co-living scheme there. And you know what? I don't have to wait in for the BT guy to come and plug my internet in for 6 hours. You know, that's just done. Oh, I don't have to worry about forgetting buying a laundry machine. There's a laundry or there's a machine in my room or whatever it is. I think I don't have to go to IKEA and come back and build a table and chairs. It's already there. I think for a lot of good reasons, I think we're seeing the co-living element of the property market, a subset of the property market, as a big opportunity area. It's again, all things property are about solving problems. And I think in London, for example, the average age for buying a house was in, you know, you used to buy a house in your late 20s. Now you're buying a house in your early 40s. And the population of London has increased dramatically. That is millions of people who would previously been homeowners aren't homeowners for the, you know, from their 20s, 30s and 40s. So clearly the co-living has a place to play in being part of the solution.
Yeah, huge opportunity by the sounds of it as well, Brian. I think it's nice to get a wide range of opinions on it, but it'll be interesting as well to see how that develops over the next few years. So, Brian, for this sort of last section, I was hoping really just to talk about your sort of your management arm, Nido Student, and perhaps, you know, over the last few years there's been an explosion really of sort of management companies. Perhaps you can just give me sort of your take on the market and, you know, what your plans are for sort of third party operations with Nido Student.
Yeah, well, I mean, with Nido Student, our objective is to become the PBSA operator of choice for students around the world. So we're investing very, very heavily in the Nido Student brand and the infrastructure to support that. So we've got some of the best people in the industry working for us, and we've got a cross-section of guys from all of the other main providers who have joined Nido Student over the last couple of years since I've been here. So, you know, we currently have baked in expansion across Ireland, the Netherlands, Portugal and Germany and others, as you know. But I think really what we want to do is redefine the industry standards for students and for investors. I think we see ourselves as solving problems for students who want to find their way into good quality, value for money accommodation across the world with a global brand, which has recognizable, consistently high standards. And also from an investor perspective, we want to be able to, we're an institutional grade property manager. So for investors, we can provide an end-to-end solution for them. So between an investor having an idea that they want to invest in purpose-built student accommodation and then them actually finding a way into the market, we like to think that we can plug that gap for on their behalf. So very reputable, well-capitalized business using the top technology and able to deliver this sort of reporting and everything else that investor needs very quickly and easily without any great hassle. That allows us to adapt to new trends through the insights and innovation we have and the engagement we have with our students through listening to them all the time and having this incredible tech backbone to the business, 90% of which is in place, and we're happy to be continuing to invest in technology. And that will change over time. I think with tech projects, you can't have a project now which you think is going to be the solution in 10 years' time. You're investing in 24-month tech cycles, after which you're in danger of throwing it all out and starting again 24 months later.
Yeah, no, definitely. And for you then, Brian, what, you know, big plan, what would be your, you know, target number of beds, do you think, say, over the next 5 years? What, you must have a sort of overall strategy, I'm sure, internally.
Well, listen, people always ask that question. I always
politely
defer to others. politely decline. But I mean, you know, we've got about 11,000 beds under management or development at the moment. We are building a scalable infrastructure which will be able to cope with a lot more beds than that. So we're in constant dialogue with investors who are approaching us and who would like us to manage their residences, because I think they recognize the value in having a brand-led, institutional grade, experienced partner on these what are large investments on behalf of investors.
Yeah. Okay, Brian, and just to finish up, final question, and you can tell me to bugger off, but I'm curious, you know, are you in this for the long haul? You've obviously been in the sector now for a long, long time. You've obviously got huge amounts to offer, but what's your plan? Are you still loving the sector, still got a lot to offer?
Listen, I'm having a great time, Nick. I mean, I'm surrounded by fantastic young people, both students and around my office, and they you know, we're constantly innovating. We're just having a great time every day we come to work. So listen, there are days when you get up at 4 a.m. and you're traveling across the world to meetings with varying degrees of success, like any business. However, you know, I think we're in a hugely exciting stage in the sector, and I just love it. It's just great.
Yeah, well, that's good. Nice way to end. And Brian, you know, I express my thanks again for coming on and joining us today. I know it's, you know, listeners might not be aware, but I know scheduling has been quite difficult. Obviously, you are traveling quite extensively. So thank you very much for coming on the show. And for any listeners, Brian, that might want to connect with you, what's the best way to go about it?
Well, I think, listen, anybody can find me on LinkedIn, and you'll find me posting stuff on there quite frequently. So search me down on LinkedIn at Brian Welsh. That'll be the best way to find me.
Okay, thanks, Brian. I'd also like to extend our thanks to today's listeners for tuning in. We do hope you'll join us for the next installment. This series of the Student Accommodation Podcast is sponsored by YFirst, a historical provider of Wi-Fi managed services for student accommodations. Regardless of whether you're in the hospitality, senior student housing industry, you know that a great Wi-Fi connection is a fundamental need for your customers. YFirst is a leader in managed Wi-Fi services for PBSA with 17 years of experience and over 1,900 residences deployed across Europe. They're the European Wi-Fi leader for your next turnkey solution, so please feel free to reach out to them at yfirst.com/EN.